I'd like to call the meeting of the House Community Regional Affairs to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:01 on Tuesday, February 5. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Present are Representative Olson, Representative Newman, Co-Chair Fairclough, and myself, Gabrielle Ledoux, Co-Chair also. Our agenda for this morning is the first hearing of HB 327, an act relating to shipping, sending, transporting, or bringing alcohol to a local option area, etc. This bill was introduced by the House Rules Committee at the request of the governor, and we do not intend to move the bill out of committee today. I understand that the AG will introduce the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Talas Kohlberg, the Attorney General, and I'm here to introduce the bill. And the bill, House Bill 327, is an alcohol bill that really is a product of efforts by different groups. The Hess review of alcohol and its effect on children is part of the source of the ideas behind this bill. Alaska Rural Justice and Law Commission is part of the source of the idea that pertains to plastic containers being in this bill, and the various departments contributed components of the bill. It prohibits a licensee from sending alcohol to a local option community in plastic bottles, and the reason for that is, if it's not already fairly well understood, is that plastic bottles conceal the noise that comes from clanking of glass bottles together. It makes it easier to determine that someone's trying to smuggle alcohol into a local option community that's already decided not to have alcohol there. It's supported by recommendations from the hearings from the Rural Justice and Law Commission and local law enforcement groups. It also imposes civil penalties on licensees if their employees are convicted of furnishing alcohol to minors, and it has a escalating scale of penalties. For first conviction, licensee would pay a civil penalty of $500. If there's a second offense within 5 years, they would pay $1,000 and have a suspension of license for 7 days, and a third conviction would be within a five-year period, a civil fine of $2,000 and a suspension of license for 30 days. A third conviction for bootlegging under this particular law within a 10-year period would be a Class C felony. Current law provides for a Class A misdemeanor for bootlegging small amounts and a Class C felony for bootlegging larger amounts. This bill will make the third conviction for small amounts within a 10-year period a Class C felony. It also adopts mandatory minimum penalties for bootlegging that are the same as mandatory minimum penalties for drunk driving, with one exception. The look-back provision for the felony drunk driving is 15 years. This bill provides for a look-back period of 10 years for bootlegging. It also allows a person convicted of bootlegging to be considered eligible for therapeutic court. It amends manslaughter law to allow for a person who bootlegs alcohol in a local option area which causes the death of another person to be prosecuted for manslaughter. This is similar to a law the legislature adopted for the sale of methamphetamines that directly cause another person's death. And so that would be a summary of the major components that are before you today. And there are other folks that can also talk to this bill. If you have questions of me, I'd be glad to try to.
Questions? Well, I've got a question then. So, you wouldn't be able to import or export using plastic bottles because of the racket that the glass bottles make as opposed to the plastic bottles, correct?
Right.
Don't people, when they import, I mean, in order to keep the bottles from breaking, wouldn't they put those, you know, like wrapped around with styrofoam or, you know, some sort of thing? I mean, if I were taking anything glass in like a suitcase or a box or something like that, I'd probably wrap it with something so that it didn't hit up against something else.
Well, I think no matter how it's being transported, there's always going to be an effort made to conceal it and protect it. It's just easier to transport plastic than it is with glass, and so it's just another effort to try to interdict it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Newman, and let also the record reflect that Representative Sisna has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Kohlberg, when we're looking at, it says in the sponsor statement that the employer or employee would have a further incentive to train their licensees. They already go through a fairly extensive training program, don't they?
Well, I think, the premise there is based on the experience with tobacco, and what we have is a chart that shows that when you have serious enforcement efforts made to punish people who have not done a good job of training, you have a significant drop in the amount of offenses that are occurring. And so the penalty does have consequences, and absent the penalty and the effort to enforce it, it seems like you can statistically show, at least in the case of tobacco, that that mechanism seems to have a beneficial impact.
Follow up?
A couple of questions, Madam Chair. Thank you. Commissioner, though, I believe anybody working in a liquor store already receives fairly extensive training on how to judge somebody's age and what the laws are. I believe that's already there in place. Am I wrong on that, or is that that's correct?
Oh, I believe you are right that's there. I think it's also true that, you know, it's the, I guess the example I draw is I've noticed, for example, when I went to the airport in Anchorage coming down here in the last couple of trips, I usually get a turkey sandwich and a Coke at the bar at the end of the airport. And it's always flattering, but I've noticed that the bartender, not just me, but everyone, is now carding everyone. She goes through the routine now, whereas, and that's happened in a couple occasions, that it just wasn't so routine not that long ago. And I think that's one of the results of people being more and more aware of the importance of not just having the law there, but there someone's going to have to answer to the consequences of not having done that. That the training is there, it's I think increasingly apparent that the penalty attached to the training makes the employer all the more certain that they're going to make sure their employees follow through with that.
And if I may mention, and I guess where I'm going on that is I know with the training programs, and I was, I had a commercial driver's license when it became mandatory with the CDLs if you're going to drive any commercial truck. And I watch people driving trucks today, and just because they have a CDL doesn't mean that they drive a truck or any more careful, or that they stop every 2 hours and do their walk-around inspections and check their brakes and do all the things that they're supposed to do, just because they have a license that says that they're going to do this. But, you know, where I'm kind of going to is where you have a second offense, and when I talked to your staff yesterday, they said that they were subjected to civil fines, but they're not subjected just to a civil fine. Their license is suspended. So now, I guess where I get a little rub on this is, you can provide all the training you want to some people, and these are jobs that are normally in a service industry, maybe pay $10 an hour, 12 maybe on a good day, if they've been there for a while. But the bottom line is that it's hard to find somebody who wants to work at 3 o'clock in the morning at some of these places, and they will make mistakes. And now you're putting the onus back on the owner of that, even though they provided all this training, so they've done everything that they are supposed to do. But they just can't, there's no way that I don't think you'll ever be able to provide an obstacle or a law. You can't write the law strong enough where, you know, I mean, you're going to come back on the owner of a business, you know, and just on his second offense, now you're going to take their license away for 7 days, and then up to 30 days on the third offense, you know, if that's what happens within 5 years, 5 years is a long time to have one or two, two or even three incidents, I think, you know, if somebody purchased underage. And I just kind of question the intent of trying to go after the owner like that when they're already providing all the training that's required by state law and then still going after them. I have a little problem with trying to infringe on that owner's business.
Well, through the chair to Representative Newman, I think you have valid considerations there, and I think it really is a judgment call on your part and how much you think holding the owner accountable for how they police their employees is really their responsibility. And all I again could do is point to a chart on tobacco that, you know, it never eliminates it completely. Obviously, there's still offenses, but it dramatically reduces the presence of that problem to have the consequences attached to it. And so there is an increased vigilance that is accompanying the owners looking into and monitoring their employees because they understand not just what they do. And I guess on the flip side of it, without the consequences, the owner really can go through the training and not be all that concerned and not have a downside to it. So I think you're right that it never completely eliminates the problem, but it seems to decrease the problem. And you with a decrease, you're less likely to get to the third offense or the second offense, which has the more significant consequences to the owner. But it is a judgment call on your part, and you kind of have to do that weighing yourself. That's just our recommendation.
Just one last quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just maybe, and I'll be glad to talk to you later on this, if you might consider something that's different than that, because here we're, you know, you have somebody who's trying to do their best as a business owner, and things happen. I don't know whether they should be held to that extent where they lose 7 days and then 30 days, you know, within 5 years. That's a little severe for somebody who's just trying to run a business, I think, when they didn't do anything wrong. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you have a question?
I do, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chairman. My first point is along the line of Representative Newman. It doesn't appear, though, on a first offense that there is a meaningful civil fine. $500, depending on the licensee, would be not very much of a payment for most. On a mom and pop, it might be a significant number. So I'd like to work with the administration to look at a first-time offense that was actually meaningful so that the training that you're looking at was meaningful right off the bat and not that we were waiting for strike two. But then I've been involved in several different trainings with chambers across the state of Alaska, and if you close a business for 5 days, whether it is through an emergency like an earthquake or whatever, you significantly reduce the chances of that business's future success just with a five-day closure. So your second offense of 5 days could put some businesses out of business. I appreciate the comparison to tobacco, but the difference in the tobacco endorsement is that we're removing a product that's availability that only affects a particular revenue stream inside of that business. Say, if you were looking at a gas station or even a liquor store that violates a tobacco law, their endorsement only reduces the segment of a particular line of revenue for that establishment, but not the entire establishment. So the closures concern me, though I think that they need to be meaningful, and I'm wondering if we can get that same meaning out of a civil fine to help pay for the costs of the enforcement that has to go along with these particular aspects. So anyway, I just in that business model, I'm very concerned with closing a business for the acts that may be outside of their control if they, in fact, do value the training that they put forward. But additionally, I'd like you to respond to, on page 2, line 9, we use the word municipality or established village, and I believe we're referencing communities that have chosen to either be wet, dry, or otherwise. And I'm wondering if that language covers second-class cities and all the different boroughs and the different if it's an umbrella word that can be used to represent communities across the state, we have a challenge to that. It's used in several points.
Local option. Through the chair, my name is Annie Carpinetti,
Thank you, Annie.
The term municipality or local village is the term used in the local option statutes, and that's what we use when we're describing local option communities.
It's used in various locations. Let me see if I can find it again, because I saw it under local options, but it's also used on page 5, line 5, and is that the same reference then just to the, it's in the violations?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, yes, that is current law, and that's the law that is used when you're discussing the entities that adopt local options. Yes.
So it's that's consistent with local option law.
Yes.
Thank you. On page 4, line 28 forward through page 5, line 6, I'm wondering, one of the issues with the tobacco laws has been a challenge in the courts to say that there needs to be a meaningful hearing before you apply penalties and for them to respond. And it appears that we're limiting the information that can be brought into it. And this isn't an appeal, but this is a hearing process. And so I'm wondering if we've provided an appropriate way for a licensee to respond to the actions of an agent or to respond to the court if they're looking at a 5-day suspension or loss of their license.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, this a similar procedure was recently upheld by the Alaska Supreme Court for tobacco enforcement. And the issue was, of course, a due process claim. And the court found that this was an adequate procedure for a licensee to litigate the closure.
Was that the holiday challenge? Do you know?
Through the chair, I believe the case involved a Juneau merchant out the road, but I'll get you the citation and the name of the case.
The reason I ask is because we had legislation before this body the first year of this session that attempted to modify the appeals process so that there was a meaningful dialogue between the courts and the licensee. So. That's where my question is coming from. I know that the court upheld it, but I'm not certain that the licensees aren't pushing it even further.
Through the chair, I'll get that information. I'm not familiar with that particular piece of legislation or the process.
Thank you.
No.
Let the record reflect that our Representative Salmon has joined us. Any further questions for either Representative Sisman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very difficult one. This is about as hard as you get, because this is totally a choice, and it's a choice that we've had, that we could have made for as long as alcohol has existed, as long as it's existed in this state. And we look at the costs of alcohol and the damage that's done by it. You know, we voted on a resolution yesterday, and I'm probably going to respond differently than I would have if it hadn't been for voting for the right for people to bear arms and to protect their families and that kind of thing. But I talked about then about the suicide, but I don't think when you have alcohol involved, it's suicide. I think it's something else. Mind-altering drugs are... it's poison, and we very sternly regulate any other severely mind-altering drug. But Alaska is Alaska, and alcohol in Alaska is really important. It's part of what the state is, you know. The changing the hours on the bars. When I came in 67, very soon after that, they started ratcheting back and not having it at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. or whatever it was to 8 a.m. or something like that. I mean, it's been this controversy over dealing with alcohol has been something that we every so often work at, but we really very much ignore the cost. And when we look at the cost of alcohol, we tend to ignore the family crises that it creates. And all of the people who, while the dad's in jail, the women who lose the custody of their children and change their job location so they can be close to the jail, so they can afford because of the costs of being in contact with family members. And ma'am, I am making a statement because other statements were made here. And I think this is a statement that has to be made, and I'm going to make it again and again. Because we keep
Representative Sisna,
on, Madam
we do,
Chair,
we do have a committee discussion. Sometimes statements are made in the context of a question. Do you have a question, Representative Sisna?
It is a question.
Thank you.
And the question is, how in the world do we really get this passed? It is a huge cost. And I want to know if this administration is really ready to take this one on, because the only way I see really dealing with a problem this big is to really bring the costs out and to really lay them in front of everyone so that people really are being really educated on how expensive this very protected industry is.
Well, I think you, through the chair, to assist, I think you do raise the crucial point, which is what is the genesis of all of this, whether it's about the local option or the licensees. Clearly, across Alaska, there is a pretty evident correlation between crime in general and alcohol and substance abuse, and that goes to domestic violence, it goes to burglary, it goes to almost anything. And the local option part of this tries to address where the problem is statistically significantly even worse than it is in the rest of the state. And what most of this is also trying to get at is minors and their involvement in these activities involving alcohol at an early age where their judgment isn't what it will be when they're older and point where they can start to develop habits that will carry through and clearly have long-term implications for people all across the state. One of the eye-opening features of the job I have is have increased opportunity to go to the rural communities, and it is a very depressing and significant problem, especially where there is minimal law enforcement even present. And as Representative Salmon pointed out last year, you know, you can pass all the laws you want, and unless you have law enforcement, it doesn't do much good. And you know, on another level, the administration and you know, even the Village Public Safety Officer Task Force have been trying to address making law enforcement more present to make some of these laws more meaningful. But it is to the point when on some of the villages where it's just downright depressing to see what's happening to young people. Especially, and you know, how do you stem that? Well, you have to have law enforcement. You have to have laws that they can do something with if they are there, and you try to interdict the problem before it gets to them. And so, do you hold a licensee who has the best of intentions, is trying to run a business, more responsible for employees who are short-term and probably not as attuned to the consequences of what they might do if they're a little bit casual? That's one mechanism to try to get at it. But how far can you go? Again, it goes back to what Representative Newman was saying. You know, how much do you hold people accountable for things that they didn't directly do themselves if it's their own livelihood at stake? And that is kind of a balancing there. But yes, this is a fairly broad-based effort by this administration to try to address these on a fairly wide basis, and it is a serious problem, and we recognize that. And what is clear is what's happening now isn't working very well, and so something should change if there's going to be a change in the end product, which is altering the level of grim statistics associated with alcohol and drug abuse in this state, which is worse than other states.
Any further questions?
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Kohlberg, this imposes some mandatory manslaughter provisions. So if you have a minor who steals some alcohol from his dad's cabinet, drives into a community that is regulated, into a dance community, and his buddy takes that fifth of whiskey out of his back of his snowmobile, chugs it, dies of alcohol poisoning. Now, is this minor, under these provisions, convicted of mandatory manslaughter?
It wouldn't be mandatory, through the chair to Representative Newman, it wouldn't be mandatory manslaughter. That is, it opens the penalty up for manslaughter, and what this is trying to address is if you're classified in the category of bootlegger, which is possible, and there's some circumstances that you're describing, but it's meant to address one of the problems with rural Alaska is bootlegging. Is fairly prevalent, and the downside to engaging in that activity is not all that significant to the bootleggers. And what this is doing is trying to make them, these are again illegal activities in local option communities that have voted not to have this product available, and someone is basically taking a commercial opportunity, not as a legitimate business in this case, but as a illegal activity, and making them responsible for the consequences. And if someone dies, manslaughter is a practical option for what has occurred. But again, you'd have a prosecutorial investigation into what's appropriate under given facts.
I mean, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, follow up. And Attorney General Kohlberg, could you just speak a little bit more into the microphone?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Madam Chair. Well, when I'm reading on page 7 here, it says the person commits the crime of manslaughter if they knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly causes the death of another person. So the way I read that, if somebody stole their dad's alcohol and had it in the back of their snow machine, and somebody took it out of there, they would be recklessly caused the death of another. And now that young adult is charged with manslaughter. That's what that says. Isn't it?
Oh, well, do you want me to?
Go ahead.
Through the chair. That is current law, Representative Newman. This bill adds paragraph 4, which is specific to manslaughter in terms of illegally bootlegging alcohol and that alcohol causing the death of another person directly. What you were reading is paragraph 1, which is current law, which under the correct circumstances and you know, in every case, you know, a prosecutor and a law enforcement officer evaluates the evidence and the circumstances, but that particular way to commit manslaughter is current law, and this bill adds just paragraph 4, which specifies that if the alcohol is bootlegged into a local option community and causes alcohol poisoning, as you mentioned, that charge could be considered.
I guess I could add to that, if I might, Madam Chairman, to represent him. Another way to look at that would be, absent you changing any law, I think what you're describing could still be prosecuted. I mean, all this is a reckless activity that leads to someone's death could still arguably be manslaughter if you did nothing to this law.
But this expands it further.
Well, this is meant to expand it to a bootlegging situation in a local option community, but if someone recklessly causes the death of someone else in Alaska, you wouldn't have to have a bootlegging to this is trying to focus on the bootlegger per se. So.
And just one more question, Madam Chair. In your sectional analysis, and I'm reading in the second paragraph, about it's the second line from the end. It says, would encourage licensees to ensure that their employees are trained and able to avoid furnished alcohol. How can you ensure that? I mean, I know that I'm kind of stuck on that point, but how does somebody own that business? How do you ensure that somebody's not going to do that?
Okay, I'm looking at, I guess, which... Look at this one.
House Bill Analysis, 327.
Yeah. Well, it's going to require someone just focusing on this particular activity and trying to monitor it. I mean, if the consequences to your livelihood and your business are more dire, you're more likely to be wanting to be involved perhaps directly or to have someone who's specifically assigned to monitor these things to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. Yes,
okay. Excuse me, through the chair, Representative Newman. I have a little answer to that just because I represent the ABC board as their attorney. And so I'm familiar with the laws and the requirements for training. And right now our current law does not require a person who serves alcohol to have training the first 30 days of their employment. So everybody who gets hired as a bartender or a clerk doesn't have to be trained for 30 days. And that is just one example of one area where a licensee might be more cautious to make sure that their employees are trained before they even start selling alcohol or serving alcohol in a bar.
But if they're going to work there, they have to be under current law.
Through the chair, they only have to get their training after 30 days of employment.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Salmon, did you have a question?
Oh, yes. I have two questions. First of all, one question is, will this law prosecute more bootleggers?
Through the chair to Representative Salmon, that would be the hope that it would have more of an impact on bootlegging than current law, that once there was a prosecution, more significant result for the bootlegger.
Go ahead.
And the other question is that I know out in the rural areas it's kind of hard, you know, the state troopers are kind of far and in between, but how could the state enforce something like this? I mean, it seems like right now they see only what they want to see, but if yet, you know, I've known bootleggers for 40 years, you know, and they're still in business, you know. And it seems to me like we don't go after those problem areas, but now we're creating more laws, but yet, you know, they seem to be operating it. I mean, when and how is that going to stop?
Through the chair to Representative Salmon, I think that you raised that very good and valid point last year when I was talking about the Rural Justice and Law Commission recommendations on bootlegging. And I think one of the things that will be likely to come before you at some point this session is recommendations from the Village Public Safety Officer Task Force trying to address increased manpower for Village Public Safety Officers through the regional corporations and the State of Alaska Public Safety Department to make more of a law enforcement presence in rural Alaska, so that some of these things will be more meaningful in terms of having someone there to enforce the laws.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me whether there was any discussion on an endorsement for a screening process for people to become or businesses to become eligible to distribute to distribution centers or into local option communities?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Under tobacco, we stamp all of the products and they have tobacco endorsements. Mm-hmm. And seeing the wide stretch problem that we have in Alaska that seems to be unique somewhat to geography at times, mm-hmm. Was there ever consideration in discussions about some kind of an endorsement to be able to sell alcohol into those damp communities, something like the tobacco endorsement? Was that discussed at all?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I did not participate in the underage drinking group, but we have a witness who will be testifying who did. So she might be able to tell you, Ms. Castro may be able to tell you whether that was discussed, but I did not participate in such a discussion.
Madam Chair, my thought process is that we are trying to strengthen the law for a worthy cause, the health of Alaskans. And it seems that we're taking a scattered approach, that we're going to have to train, or businesses will have to train hundreds of employees, but a single-shot approach might be to authorize only particular vendors to sell to the distribution so that your training could be more specific for those communities who've chosen to go local option. But I don't know if that runs awry with any other laws as far as competition goes inside of communities, any antitrust laws. But
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, Doug Griffin, who is the director of the ABC board, I think might be helpful. He is online, and he could describe to you what businesses do send to local option areas. There aren't that many, actually, companies that do send in response to written order to local option communities, and he could tell you what. Last year, you passed a law that required these businesses to participate in a database so that they could have checks and balances on which ones sent certain amounts to particular people in local option areas, and he may have some more information to you for you in that regard.
Thank you.
Mr. Griffin, are you on the line?
Yes, ma'am. I am, Madam Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, my name is Doug Griffin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Would you like me to address Representative Faircloth's question?
Yes.
Presently, package stores that are engaged in what we call a written order process, where they can go through a method to legally ship alcoholic beverages to damp communities. These are communities that have, by local option, voted to not allow sales or licenses within their jurisdiction, but that does allow for the importation and possession of alcohol. Presently, as Ms. Carpinetti described, we are engaged in enacting this database project, which is part of Senate Bill 128 that the legislature passed last year. There are 19 package stores that register with us. We don't have any kind of an endorsement, and that may not be such a bad idea that Representative Faircloth proposes. That would add a little more formality to the process. It's a little more informal process now, but package stores that do wish to engage in written order process are required to notify us. This is for purposes of us to keeping them informed when there are changes in the local option. Say a village that was damp becomes dry, we send them out a new list of the communities and highlight that change that they can no longer ship to that community. We also provide them with conviction lists of people that are no longer allowed to order by written order due to conviction for bootlegging. And so there's various communication that we have with these package stores along those lines so that they don't fall into sending to someone that they're not supposed to mail to. That relationship, I think, is going to get stronger, clearly, with this database. We are going to be providing more training. We did get a new position associated with that law, and our feeling is as we get that implemented, people in written order will have to access the database via the Internet. We are going to try to obviously have that introduced in as smooth a way as possible, but we know there's going to be some learning curve and disruption to the process. But I think one of the benefits of just having this more formalized database is that we will strengthen our relationship with package stores that do sell by written order. Some may not be totally complying with all of the different aspects of the program, and we hope to tighten that up as one of the benefits of this written order process.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I have a question for Mr. Griffith.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Griffith, do you feel that less package stores ship alcohol actually just shipped alcohol, because, you know, there was legislation again passed last year that makes it mandatory that if you are going to, if you're a package store and you ship alcohol to a community, that you have to record that and send that to a state database. Do you feel that less package stores ship alcohol now to rural Alaska? Is that, you know?
Well, Representative Newman, through the chair, that hasn't implemented. My sense is that there may be some of these 19 package stores that now we have on our list that ship by written order that will decide that this is too cumbersome, not worth it. The small part of their business is shipping, so we may see that number shrink just because of the additional requirements of the state. There are a couple of package stores that are going to have to decide whether they want to put in a computer and connect to the internet to participate, but that is going to be a new requirement placed on them because they're going to have to be part of the program in terms of recording their sales in the database. So, even though 19 are on our list, my sense is that there's probably less than that are really active in this. They just they may have gotten on our list to ship by written order, but they don't do very many of them, and they may just do a few a year. They may just have one or two clients out in rural Alaska that they ship to. So I think the bulk of the written orders are done by probably 5 or 6 stores in Alaska. They're the ones that have come to some of our meetings regarding the implementation of the database. So I think they have, just by their presence at our meetings, show that they have a major financial stake in the whole written order process.
And, Madam Chair. And currently, Doug, right now, if a package store wants to ship to anywhere in rural Alaska or ship anywhere within the state, they have to have a computer in there so that they can be connected electronically to the state's database. They have to check and make sure that nobody who is on your do not sell list, I guess, or convicted list, so that they don't sell to them, or else they can be charged by the state or fined by the state.
Representative Newman, through the chair, frankly, now, presently, this new database is to go into effect July 1st of this year, and we are on target to have that implemented and in place by that time. We're working on this, feverishly working on this project right now to get it up and running, where the law actually required us to do consultation with package stores that are in the business. We are doing that. We've actually gone out to the city of Bethel and the city of Kotzebue to have meetings with local officials out there. So we're trying to roll this thing out in a way that I think was intended by the legislature. Presently, they do not have to have a computer. Records are kept, and they are to be kept for a year. It's just they're in some file. It's very, I won't even say 20th century, it's probably 19th century record-keeping system. The database, we hope, will actually make some things easier for package stores, in that we can put things in there like the list of people they're not to sell to, which are now just in a form of a paper list that they have to check against every time someone places an order to make sure an individual is not on the bootlegging list. And again, of course, there can be confusion there based on similar or identical names, different identity issues that arise. Those things could still happen under a computerized system, but we hope to have a unique identifier number for people that would eliminate some of that. The whole idea behind the database is that there was a sense, again, from the rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission, that there were people that were bootleggers gaming the system and buying their monthly quota from more than one package store. And so one of the big goals of the database is to prevent that second and third order beyond your limit to a different store would be captured by this database, would act as somewhat of a clearinghouse to not allow those multiple orders to be placed.
And
actually, there's a prevention element built into the law for that too, so that in versus charging somebody criminally there, it would just deny that order once someone reaches their limit for the entire month going to the second or third package store. Sometimes that could be done in error, More than likely, it's done intentionally for purposes of trying to get large quantities of alcohol for resale in rural Alaska. But we actually, the bill is preventative in nature in trying to prevent that from occurring.
And Doug, if I may, Madam Chair, Doug, out of respect for the time in this committee, this can just be more or less a yes or no question. So this legislation would make it so that if you are a package store, you have to have a computer and you have to file all this electronically to a state database.
That bill was passed last year. That this legislation before you today does not really address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else have any questions for Doug Griffith?
I have
Representative Salmon.
I have a question. I'm kind of fairly new to the system, but in your database or however you do it, how do you identify whether the person that's ordering is legal age?
Well, presently, even under the present system, at the very beginning of setting up an account for being able to order by written order, a piece of identification, state-issued or some kind of government-issued identification has to be provided to the package store. And so that initially sets up the account. And then when we say it's by written order, we literally mean by written order, an old-fashioned letter, not a fax, not an internet request, not a telephone call, so that signatures can be compared to that original identification that sets up the account. So that's the means used to ensure that the person is initially over the age of 21 years of age, or 21 or older.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Griffin?
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I have been listening to your comments, and I do think, I'll just make it very brief. I know your time is short. I think the committee fully understands sort of the trade-off here about trying to deal with this problem of alcohol, and how do you look at penalties for licensees, clerks, et cetera. And so I salute the committee. I think you really have a handle on some of the things that we grapple with every day about what's a fair penalty for someone engaged in the sale of alcohol.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Carpinetti? All right, then I've got a question for you.
For me?
Yes.
I thought he was finished.
Here comes the judge.
Okay, Section 8 on page 7. The new 4.
Yes.
Attorney General Kohlberg said that this wasn't a mandatory manslaughter charge. I guess I'm confused about that. I mean, that somewhat looks mandatory to me.
Madam Chairman, I guess I'm having trouble understanding what you mean by a mandatory charge. Whenever a crime is allegedly committed, the police investigate, they send the information they have to the district attorney, and they evaluate the facts based on the law and what the district attorney thinks they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You would be choosing manslaughter if there's a death of a person, you would evaluate the facts based on all of our homicide laws and fit whether the facts could be proven to that particular level of crime. But there's no mandate that says that a person under these particular circumstances, a person must be charged with manslaughter under any of the various theories of manslaughter in our current law or this proposed additional one.
Okay, let's just use the example of the teenager. Let's say it's stipulated that she's underage, her boyfriend is underage, she's stolen alcohol from her father, and she's given it to her boyfriend, and her boyfriend dies of alcohol poisoning. All of those facts are stipulated. There's no doubt about them. Under what circumstances would that be meant? Why would one choose to charge manslaughter in one instance and not another instance with those facts, beyond doubt?
beyond a reason. Well, you know, under those facts, you might be able to charge that youngster. I mean, this would be going under the juvenile justice system. It wouldn't be under the adult system. So you wouldn't be charging her at all. You would be maybe filing, and we have Mr. Newman here who is more familiar with the juvenile justice system than I am, but she would be a juvenile, and they would look at whether or not they would want to file an accusation under the circumstances. And especially in the juvenile arena, there are various choices of how to deal with that particular child, whether or not the culpability involved, and decide whether an accusation would be filed. And that same process would be followed in the adult arena, in the sense that whether she violated ASO 411010, which is importing into and selling without a license, and whether it was a local option area, and whether the person died as a direct result of alcohol. And then you have to understand, I mean, you have to realize that prosecutors, we know, exercise discretion under the circumstances and decide what is the just charge in addition to where those facts fit into the law.
And when we talk about juvenile, for purposes of alcohol, somebody remains a juvenile until they're 21 years old, correct?
Madam Chairman, no. Somebody remains a juvenile until they turn 18,
right,
in our state.
So, in other
words,
they
can't drink until they're 21.
They can't
but
drink.
But they're dealt with in the juvenile system until they're 18.
Yes. So that an 18 plus one day year old under those scenarios would be charged in the adult system, not the juvenile system.
If whatever act she did occurred after her 18th birthday, that would be considered part of the adult system, yes.
All right, thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Thank you.
Thank you.
And I believe we also have here Diane. Is it Casto or Castro?
Casto.
Casto.
Thank you. Although I'm often called Castro. A common mistake. My name is Diane Casto. I am the manager of Prevention and Early Intervention Services for the Division of Behavioral Health within Health and Social Services. And what I want to talk about today is to give a little bit of information about our youth and the underage drinking problem, and why we believe in Health and Social Services that this bill is so important. And one of the programs that I also manage within the prevention section is the tobacco control. So I can respond to a couple of the questions that came up earlier regarding the tobacco laws and the changes that occurred last year, and how those kind of interface with some of the changes that are recommended in this bill. So first of all, the department does support this bill, and we believe that alcohol is a huge problem in the state of Alaska, as we've all acknowledged here in the last few minutes, and it is particularly a problem among our youth. Underage drinking as a national issue has gained a lot of attention over the last few years. In 2002, the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine were tasked with coming up with a national strategy to reduce underage drinking. They, in 2004, produced the Reducing Underage Drinking, a Collective Responsibility. This became the kind of foundation for much of the work that states are doing now in order to develop plans, state plans, to begin reducing underage drinking. In 2004, Congress established the Federal Interagency Coordinating Committee to reduce and prevent underage drinking. And as a result of that, in 2005, Alaska established a similar interagency coordinating committee that developed what I believe you all have in your packet is the Alaska Plan to Reduce and Prevent Underage Drinking. This was released in partnership with the Surgeon General of the United States at our Alaska Health Summit on December 4th, and is currently available for public comment. So we're trying to get a lot of information from the communities about underage drinking and what these critical issues are. The Surgeon General also in 2007 had a call to action to prevent and reduce underage drinking. So just to set the groundwork, it's getting a lot of attention. The country as a whole is recognizing that we need to begin addressing this issue more strongly than we currently are. So Alaska is moving in that direction. As part of our plan to prevent underage drinking, in March we will be hosting a series of 26 town hall meetings across the state in various communities to get, again, community response and community insight into what is happening in their community, because as we know, every community has different issues. But one thing that has been consistent in all of these reports, in all of these committees, in everything that has been put forward, is that one of the most effective environmental strategies to prevent and reduce underage drinking is to limit and reduce access to alcohol for youth. That access to alcohol is one of the most critical issues that we face in combating underage drinking, and also changing the attitude regarding youth and alcohol. And I think Representative Sisna touched on that when she was speaking, that I have heard it too often when I hear parents say, well, thank goodness my child is only drinking beer and not using drugs. Well, alcohol is the number one drug of choice among our youth, and it is the most damaging, the most deadly. There are more accidents related to alcohol. Both in Alaska, we have lots of snow machines, we have, you know, skiing, we have driving, lots of activities that youth are intoxicated, and high rates of accidents, high rates of death and injury. We also have very high rates of suicide among our young people. In Alaska, the suicide rates for ages 15 to 24 are significantly higher than the rate for suicide among the whole population. And in the United States, the young people are the lowest number of suicides. In Alaska, it's the highest. And at the same time, almost 40% of all suicides have alcohol are associated with our suicide rates. So clearly there are some problems. But there is some good news as well. And as you probably are all aware, every 2 years Alaska participates in the CDC Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the YRBS as we affectionately call it. And in this recent fall, we got the results from the 2007 YRBS, and in all of the categories related to youth and drinking, we are starting to see small but significant changes in the rates, and that things are going down. But as even with going down, in 2007, 73.6% of grades 9 through 12 of the students reported having had at least one drink of alcohol on one or more days in the past 30 days. 73%. Now that's down from 75% a couple of years ago, but you know, at least we're starting down, but that's still a huge number of our youth who are drinking, grades 9 to 12. We also know that one of the studies that has been done over the years is that the rates of lifetime dependence on alcohol declined from more than 40% of those youth who start drinking at the age of 14 or younger to roughly 10% become dependent if they start drinking at 20 or older. In Alaska, 20.4% of students reported having had their first drink of alcohol, that's more than just a few sips, before age 13. That means that approximately 40% of those youth will become dependent on alcohol in their lifetime, which takes it out of the underage drinking and puts it into the adult issues. 9.7% of high school students reported drinking and driving at least once in the past 30 days. Again, that's gone down from 11.3% a couple of years ago, but almost 10% of our students are drinking and driving. The fact that our youth and their brains are not fully developed anyway, and the fact that you then add alcohol onto that and driving, it to me as a parent, it's a scary situation. So there are a number of data points that we have. We are beginning to get a little bit of a handle on the alcohol problem with youth, but it is still a significant problem. A couple of things that I wanted to address related specifically to HB 327 and its impact on underage drinking in Alaska, and a number of these have been addressed. There are a couple of things specifically in the bill that address minor consuming. One is the issue of increased penalties for those who sell alcohol to minors. Another one is to develop a database. Currently, we do not have a statewide consistent database for tracking minor consuming citations. Minor consuming is a citation. It's not a misdemeanor. But right now, depending upon when they happen and which court they're in, we don't have a consistent process to know when we have multiple and repeat minor consuming. So a judge could be making a decision thinking it was the first time offense, but in fact it could be the fourth or fifth time offense. So one of the things we are proposing in this bill is to develop a more consistent tracking system through DMV that would tie in with their eventual driver's license to make sure we're tracking minor consuming. And then, of course, the issue of access in damp and dry communities is another one that is critical to helping our youth limit their access to alcohol. So we totally and completely support all of those issues as well. But I would like to address for a minute the issues that were brought up related to the comparison of alcohol penalties and tobacco penalties. And Representative Fairclough mentioned that last year we had some changes in the tobacco laws, and they were as a result of a court decision in the Holiday case. You were correct. That case we lost. That was over a year ago, and it related to due process and said that the laws as they existed did not allow the owner, the retailer, due process when their clerk was charged with selling tobacco to a minor. So we had legislation last year that did eventually pass. It was combined with Senate Bill 84, which was the self-extinguishing tobacco bill that passed. And what we did in that was to recognize that we certainly did not want to not provide folks with their due process, that was a critical issue. But what we also fought very hard for was to make sure that our penalties with the due process were still fair but firm. And Alaska, of all 50 states, has the most stringent laws related to tobacco in the country. We are the only state that does have a mandatory fine on a first offense. But what we believe, and the chart that our Attorney General was showing you with the decline, that we dropped significantly in 2002 when the laws changed to increase those penalties for those who sold tobacco to minors. And one of the interesting things is that we currently have three tobacco investigators. For alcohol, they have one investigator that does all of the enforcement and compliance checks with youth. So oftentimes our tobacco enforcement will work with the alcohol enforcement, and the same youth that is denied a tobacco sale can often go in and purchase alcohol. And we truly believe that is because the laws are so lenient for the sale of alcohol to minors. A couple of the things that, well, let me backtrack. The other issue that Annie Carpinetti discussed was related to, there was a second court case, and that was with Tesoro here in Juneau, and that one we was upheld, and it said that we did provide enough due process. So there's some difference of opinion, but we did make some changes in our current law to make sure we're covering that. But I think one of the major differences between the tobacco penalties and the alcohol penalties is that there is a ceiling of how high the fines can go, but there's also a floor, and that there will always be some penalty. In the alcohol current law, only the clerk is given a fine and or it says jail time. It's a Class A misdemeanor, but the reality is that those in talking with the folks who enforce that most often there is no fine, there is no, basically it's a probationary type action, and that there really isn't a penalty assessed with that first offense.
Excuse me, do you have a question?
I did. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yes, Diane, the question I have is, when you were talking about that the tobacco had three people who did the investigations, and that there was only one in the alcohol, And then you made a further statement about the fact that the same children would be caught on the tobacco. But I'm wondering if, in fact, we couldn't compare on the tobacco and alcohol the number of enforcement people there are all the way along the line. And I don't know that that was the point you were making, but it almost seemed as if you have enough people, then you're more likely to be able to do the kind of enforcement you need. It's the same thing with the VPSO. If we don't have enough VPSO in rural Alaska, how are you going to enforce anything?
Through the chair, Representative Sisney, you're absolutely right that I believe that has been another part of the success of tobacco, is that we have consistently been able to keep a group, a team approach of people who are going out throughout the year. Tobacco is also different in that we have the SINAR legislation, which is federal legislation, that mandates that all states who receive a federal substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant, which is out of SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, that we have to maintain a 20% or less sell rate or we lose a portion of our block grant dollars. So further incentive for us in the tobacco world to maintain a healthy force of a team of individuals going out and doing investigations. So I would agree with you. And I think that the other part of tobacco where we have been fortunate is that we have had some of the tobacco funds to support our activities.
That would be.
Let's see. I think actually I was. Oh, I just one last comment, and then I will stop and take questions. Again, I think the critical difference is the fact that there is not a concrete fine or penalty on a first offense. It can be given, you know, it can be changed, it can be reduced. And the other difference is that currently in the tobacco, it is only the clerks that are cited, not the businesses. What we found in tobacco is that with the business owners themselves having responsibility over their employees, that they have, and this again was discussed earlier, that they do have a stronger commitment to making sure that they set the right example, the right tone, that they let their employees know clearly that this is a priority and you will not sell tobacco to minors. So I think those are the two critical differences between tobacco and alcohol. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to open the meeting now to public testimony, which I probably should have done actually before Ms. Casto's testimony, but I don't think that there are any adverse consequences from not doing it before. So is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Okay, then we have a number of people online. We've got Lieutenant Dial, but I think he's just for questions. Doug Griffin for questions. We've got Susan McLean from the Department of Law. Susan, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I know you, Representative Ledoux. I don't know anyone else on the committee, and I will
just
briefly
answered my first question. You're the Susan McLean that I must have known about 15 years ago.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Well, I am currently employed as the chief assistant attorney general in the criminal division by the Department of Law, but I have been a prosecutor in Alaska on and off since 1982, and I have prosecuted cases in Kodiak, Kenai, Anchorage, Juneau, and Bethel. And why I'm here today is to talk to you a little bit about maybe anecdotally what my observation is of how very different Bethel is, or Western Alaska is, from the rest of the state in terms of how alcohol affects the communities and how it impacts crime in that part of the state. And I come from a place where I've had long-term opportunities to look at some of these other places, and I say to you today, there is no place in Alaska with more violent crime than Western Alaska. And my experience, and I have been the district attorney in Bethel, by the way, is that there is every reason for those communities to be dry and to understand why they need to be dry. I was racking my brain today to try to think of a single case of a serious nature in Bethel or any of the 56 villages in the YK Delta in which alcohol was not involved. Sadly, most of the cases that have the most tragic results involve crimes that are committed by young people against family members while other family members witness. And they're serious violent crimes. There are, I thought of two. I want to back up a little bit and say one more thing. I came back to work for the Department of Law 2 years ago to start a rural prosecution program. And the purpose of the rural prosecution program is to provide assistance to primarily Western Alaska and areas of Alaska in which the attorneys are so overwhelmed by what they are doing that they need outside help. And so in that capacity, I just kind of looked at the cases I handled in Bethel or was personally assigned to within the past year, and they involve crimes which occurred in villages. I thought of two right immediately where what the sequence of events had been was a young person was threatening suicide, a parent tried to intervene, and the parent was shot. I cannot describe to you the scenes in courtrooms when you have family members as torn as they are in wanting to support maybe a 19 or 20-year-old person who has killed or seriously wounded another family member. And most tragically, the person who has committed the crime and who is undoubtedly going to get some sort of sanction does not remember what he has done. I say that it is crystal clear to me that the bootlegger who brings a small amount in for the third time ought to be facing the deterrent of a felony crime. I do know from my recent time in Alaska, for example, or in Bethel, for example, that typically, anecdotally, the typical situation is that a bootlegger will buy a pint bottle of very cheap alcohol, like R&R whiskey or Gilby's vodka, for, I assume, less than $10. And the going rate for that bottle of alcohol in Alakanuk is $150 to $200. So there is a tremendous profit motive in bootlegging. These are families that don't have the $200 to spend for the alcohol, but find it somehow. And it is ripping families apart who are used to being close-knit and to living a subsistence lifestyle. For that reason, I can't say enough about the importance of this law. I do want to address, however, a question that came up, and I realize people may have questions for me, about the hypothetical, about what about the, concerning the teenager who takes alcohol from a parent's cabinet and takes it into a dry area and maybe gives it to her boyfriend and maybe he dies. And as a prosecutor, the question was, is this a mandatory manslaughter? And so I'm maybe going to do a quick legal analysis, which is I don't see that being chargeable as a manslaughter because the statute provides that the person who provided the alcohol would have had to violate AS 0411010, which deals with the sale or barter of alcohol. And in fact, a person is not presumed to have been providing alcohol for sale or barter unless what they've provided is more than 10.5 liters. So I would see that that hypothetical crime is lacking the element of sale or barter, and therefore that teenager who gave the alcohol, I don't think could be charged with the crime because I would see it as lacking an element. And I'm certainly open to any questions anyone may have.
Thank you, Susan. Any questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Walter Evans from DJJ.
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Could you identify yourself, what DJJ is?
That's the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Thank you.
Okay, and my name is Walter Evans. I'm the Chief Probation Officer for the Northern Region, Division of Juvenile Justice. I oversee juvenile probation offices in Bethel, Barrow, Nome, Kotzebue, and Fairbanks. And I'd like to thank you for taking up this bill and giving serious attention to the issue of alcohol, particularly in our rural areas. By now, I'm sure you're all familiar with the impact that alcohol abuse is having on rural Alaska and Alaska's kids. I witnessed this impact myself during the 7 years I spent as a juvenile probation officer serving Bethel and the many villages on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. During that time, I witnessed firsthand the way alcohol makes young people, who are already impulsive just because they're young people, even more impulsive and indifferent to the effects of their behavior on others. When they drink, their ability to control their own actions is reduced and their understanding of the consequences of their actions becomes blurred. Our rural staff estimate that between 50 and 80% of all crimes we see by juveniles involve alcohol in some way, whether they are intoxicated when they commit the crime or they commit the crime to get alcohol or money to buy alcohol. The cause and effect is clear. The more readily alcohol is available to young people, the more likely they are to commit crimes. The more we can limit the access to alcohol by youth, the more we can hopefully limit the crimes they commit because they're intoxicated or addicted. This bill does a lot of different things to keep alcohol out of the hands of young people, but probably the most useful thing from our perspective in juvenile justice is in seeking to establish a tracking mechanism for minor consuming cases. Currently, when an individual is cited for underage drinking or possession, the justice system has a difficult time establishing the number of times a youth has been cited previously, or whether compliance with education or treatment requirements from an earlier case was achieved. This bill lays the groundwork for an improved system of tracking minor consuming offenses, hopefully resulting in a coordinated approach across agencies working with these youth to monitor and report on the outcomes associated with a minor consuming offense. Thanks for listening, and I'd be happy to stay on the line and answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we also have on the line Quinlan Steiner from the Public Defenders and Ronald Taylor from the Division of Behavioral Health, both of them for questions. Any questions for either of those? Yes, Representative Salmon.
I have a question for the first person that testified. I forget her name.
Was testified online or here?
Just a question of bootlegging.
Okay.
That was a
Susan prosecutor? McLean?
I think so.
Okay. Susan, are you still there?
She's no longer online.
Okay. That would be great.
Okay. Any further questions of anybody? Well, then I'm going to close the public testimony. Committee discussion. Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, I would like to have the opportunity to set this aside today and get with the administration to look at the civil penalties that are currently inside of 327.
As I mentioned, I wasn't going to bring this out today. Representative Olson.
For the next meeting, I'd like a little more input from the Department of Corrections rather than an indeterminate fiscal note, possibly based on 10 days of Class A at 3 months, 6 months, and 10 days or 10 prisoners at Class C for 5 years, just so we can get a handle on the numbers.
Okay.
It can be a hypothetical fiscal note, but just something out in front of us where we can get some costs.
Ms. Carpinetti, can you provide that information?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I would like to want to apologize for the fact that I got carried away in my talking about the issue. But I think I'm a good example of what happens in families, and it was 13 years ago. But it's raw underneath, and that's part of what we're looking at out there. Just the amount of damage that's been done for the amount of years. But number two, I think that Representative Faircloth is absolutely correct that that in the things that we do to try to provide disincentives, that the sooner the better and the tougher the better. And if in fact we had, I think, a little bit more costly penalty in the first offense, that is, I think that there's actually been research that's shown that that's much more effective to have the initial offense something that really hurts, and then that's more likely to change behavior more successfully.
Thank you. Any further discussion or comments? Well, then it is 8:22, and I will close this hearing.